ccartscouncil.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. George Zimmerman's acquittal in the fatal shooting of Trayvon Martin 4 years ago ignited a national conversation about race and justice, and it sharply divided people. Some viewed the photo of Martin, a young man in a hoodie, and saw a threat. Others, including President Obama, saw someone who could be their son. Davy Sutton, a journalist and filmmaker, recognized this tragedy as an opportunity to bring the discussions black parents regularly have with their children out into the open, an opportunity to discuss one aspect of black life in America. And the result is her documentary, What We Told Our Sons, Families React to the Trayvon Martin Verdict. That film will be screened in Charlotte on Thursday evening at 6:30 at the Levine Museum of the New South. We have details about that on our website at WFAE.org. And here to talk about her work right now is Davy Sutton. Welcome to the program. Welcome back to Charlotte, by
Yes,
way.
Thanks for having me.
Because you've been on television here and other assorted things, and you're in Atlanta now, right?
I am in Atlanta now.
Well, welcome back. The film features four families, three black, one white, all with teenagers, and two of the participants in the film are with us in our Spirit Square studio right now. Venetia St. Villas and her son Stanley live here in Charlotte, and they join us now after a late flight back from New York. Thank you for being here so early in the morning for you.
Good morning, and thank you to you guys for having us.
I'll try to keep you awake. Stanley, how are you?
Good. How about you?
Okay, I'm fine. One thing we'll talk about this hour is something that becomes readily apparent as the young people in this film share their thoughts. For some, the realities of being a young black male in America becomes one of those landmark moments in life where suddenly your worldview is altered. A few appeared a little blindsided by the unfairness of this reality, and since these conversations are continuing in homes today, we invited Dr. Hank Harris, the chair of the Department of Counseling at UNC Charlotte, to share some advice on having those tough conversations with children and more. Welcome to you.
Yeah, good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Davy, you've done a lot of different things in this business. I mean, you've done everything. A lot of sports broadcasting. You have, I think, two sports Emmys to your credit. Is this your first documentary?
It is my first documentary.
So why start here? What moved you to produce this documentary? It's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. It was daunting, and I kind of knew that going in. But, of course, when you're in it, you're right. Like, wow, why am I doing this by myself?
So what moved you to do this?
I had been at a point in my career where I wanted to do more long-form content. And at that time when I started, I thought the only route was to do a full-fledged documentary where – now I know I could do like a 10-minute story and be just fine. But I was actually at the Gantt Center with Venetia right after the verdict. And I had been in the space of wanting to create content in this, tell longer stories and letting people tell their stories. And then I knew the verdict, everybody had a reaction to the verdict. Didn't matter what side you are. It was just an emotional thing for our country. And as people of color, I was like, well, what do you tell your sons? Because the kid was in his own neighborhood and he, was just walking around and he died. So how do you tell your sons? Because on a day-to-day basis, people just want to protect their family. Not everybody is marching in the streets. On a day-to-day basis, they want to feed them and protect them. So I asked her, and we were looking at an exhibit, our guest today, Venetia, and I, and at that moment, it was almost surreal because she's telling me the answer, but I was like, I think this is the project that you're going to do. Mm. So that's what prompted me.
What was your reaction, Venetia, when you heard the verdict?
At that time, as I shared with Davy, he was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And as irony would have it, when people see the documentary, there is a picture that they show of Trayvon Martin with the football uniform on. And he had an exact football picture that mirrored Trayvon Martin's picture.
Right.
And I could see my son growing into look like Trayvon Martin. And I said to her, the verdict, while we should not have, some of us should not have been surprised, it still didn't mean that it wasn't hurtful and that our hearts didn't break. And no matter what side you were with believing that the verdict was correct or not correct, I think most of us that have sons, and especially sons of color, it was scary because it's one thing to look at the media and look at TV and you're seeing older kids gunned down or young men gunned down. But it's different when you're looking at a 12 or a 14 or 15-year-old. And now my son is 13, so the entire what's happening in America is definitely feeling a little bit closer to home even than when he was 8 and 9. So shock initially, but I remember sitting in my office watching the TV, watching the verdict, and tears just kind of rolling down my face because of the pain as a mom.
One of the first things that appeared on the screen in this documentary is a simple, for lack of a better, it's not a slide, but it's a phrase, a word. A series of words. It says, at what age do they become a threat?
Mm-hmm. My nephews, as babies in front of Christmas, at a Christmas tree. And they were, it was a meme. That's the term that they,
exactly.
A meme. So I did that before doing the documentary. And that's the question, kind of like a in-your-face question. You're looking at adorable babies. And I think generally they're cute kids. So we were always getting stopped in the street, like how cute those kids are. And it's a question that I thought a mom would ask. So when does he become a threat? Because we just want to know when we need to protect them a little more when they cannot play in the streets.
You produced this film, right? You began working on it right after that. And I guess when did it first come out? When did you first screen it?
I screened it at a conference, Netroots Nation, in July of 2014.
Okay.
And that was actually an emotional screening because you may not recall, but Bernie Sanders was interrupted by Black Lives Matter protesters at this one, and that actually made national news. Mm. So people were – Sandra Bland had just died, and so people were just emotionally charged at this conference. Netroots Nations is a conference where a lot of activists for many different reasons go in one spot.
And you've shown this, and you go around the country showing this. You're usually in attendance, and you have little workshops, which you will have here as well, after, to talk about the film. And we've had a chance to talk about these shootings over and over and over and over again over time. And in the course of having these conversations, it was revealed that this is a conversation that African-American parents have with their sons on a regular basis. You said, I've read something that you said, that when you screen this, and there's a mixture of people in the audience, early on at least, there were white people who never knew that this conversation was had by African-American parents and their children.
There are still white people who don't know that this is a conversation that people, black and brown people, have with their children.
So what's their reaction when they find that out?
They take a step back and then, you know, the museum crowd, the reason I like showing that the museum crowds are usually open and ready to, like, exchange with an open mind. And so they take a step back, and then I feel like they just learn something new, which is a step forward.
Does it change them in some way, do you think?
I feel it does change them because they know that they go through their lives not having – it's just – I think it's another piece of evidence that they are moving through their lives with a certain amount of privilege, which seems to be an inflammatory word when you bring it up. And I know this from, like, social media using it, but the privilege of not having to have these considerations before you leave the house, that is a luxury. I think that's just kind of – that's the reason why I wanted to – this is my way, a tool to get people to kind of see where each other is coming from.
And you've had these discussions over the course of several years after screening this film. And in over the course of those several years, a lot of young African-American men have died. Have the discussions, as the nature of the discussion, changed over time, given all of that?
I think the nature of discussion has always been, when we're talking about it, there's always like a new hashtag or name that we're talking about. So it's always fresh, and there's always a recounting of the most recent incident. And I think it's evolving in the sense that there's somebody, a new situation. And I think the most recent one with the white woman being killed, that's kind of treading territory. Like, is anybody safe? And maybe there's going to be a new awakening among people, among, you know, white people thinking like, oh, maybe it's not just a, like, you can't, they can't default that it might just be a brown and black problem. It actually is a problem that we've been talking about.
You're referring to the Australian woman who was killed in Minneapolis just over the weekend, I believe, by police after she called in what she thought was some kind of a dispute in her backyard or in an alley, and she went down to the cruiser to meet the police when they arrived, and they shot her.
Yes.
You started this film by looking for families who would talk to you about this, and I get the impression that you asked a lot of different ways, including on Facebook, and you started out with about 100 people, narrowed it down to 20, and ended up with 4 different families in this film. This is what's so hard about part of what's so hard about this. How did you decide on the final 4?
I wanted it not to be redundant, right? So we're having 4 families, so everybody's coming from a different point of view. So I wanted to make sure that in addition to having the narrative of peeking inside a family's discussion about racism and social justice, that everybody was coming from different points of view, even the children and how they were and how they're being raised and what their point of awakening is. Like everybody has a most impactful when they've seen the film, they are touched by a particular thing. Mine was with Stanley, who was here. He was 9 and they're growing up in a really nice neighborhood and it's predominantly white. And one of Venetia's concerns was, there might, at what age does he become a threat? Where like they've been living in the neighborhood since he was 4, and he's been playing with Brad and Chad since he was 4. But if they're riding bikes when he's 13, which he is 13 now, around the corner to somebody who's just moved in, are they going to? Is he going to be in harm's way?
Yeah.
And so there, you hear kind of these narratives. But my most heartbreaking moment is when Stanley is trying to process. 9-year-old Stanley is trying to process. Like, so why don't they like me? Why are people out there that don't like me? And that's a heartbreaking realization that he's black.
that was several years ago, Stanley.
Yes, sir.
How do you? Do you still dwell on that? Is that a question you still ask yourself?
I've learned to expand on it, and I'm understanding why some people don't like me because of my skin tone or just the way I look. But my 9-year-old self, I didn't completely understand the full thing, but as I got older, I started to understand what's going on in society and how they don't.
It's okay. It's just radio.
How they don't
have different views.
Different views. Yeah. Then
is it that they don't like you, or is it that you feel they fear you?
Well, some people they just don't like me because of my skin tone, and some people fear me because of what happens in other towns. Like when Trayvon Martin got shot, there were so many riots with African American protesters. That is sort of put a fear and targets on our backs for fear and towards most African-American people.
Yeah. That's a terrible thing to have to carry around. I mean, you're 9 years old in this film. You're 13 now. You've done nothing wrong in your life. We've all done things wrong in our lives, but you've done nothing seriously wrong in your life. To carry that burden around is completely unfair. How do you do it?
Well, I actually don't know.
Okay. Well, I'll hop in a little as mom, and I'll say that his dad and I definitely stay in conversation with him about understanding people looking at you as a human and as a person of color.
And we're going to talk about that conversation as we go through the hour. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Miles McClellan Construction, dedicated to meeting each of their clients' needs when it comes to project performance and its technical requirements. More info about Miles McClellan's approach at mmbuildings.com. And Hendrik Volkswagen of Concord, offering a summer selection of vehicles, new and used. Details at Hendrik Volkswagen of Concord and at the Hendrik Automall Concord Mills or Hendrik VW of Concord.com. Well, today, Major League Soccer reps are in Charlotte to get the lay of the land. Thursday, a Charlotte City Council committee takes a look at stadium funding, something the county did months ago, though a planned meeting between county and MLS officials unraveled over concerns about transparency. Decisions still have to be made on how we're going to treat this soccer bid. So we're going to talk to City Council's Julie Eiselt, County Commissioner Matthew Reidenauer, and a Major League Soccer reporter about all this tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the Trump administration weighs a new policy to expand and expedite deportations of illegal immigrants. We'll look at who would be affected and what it would mean. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up this morning at 10, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the film What We Told Our Sons, Families Reacted to the Trayvon Martin Verdict, which will be screened at the Levine Museum of the New South at 6:30 on Thursday evening. Davy Sutton is the filmmaker involved in that, the documentarian, a journalist. You've probably seen her on TV. She was here in Charlotte for a while. Venetia and Stanley St. Villas are with us. Venetia is Stanley's mom. Stanley is 13. He's in the film at the age of 9, and so is Venetia and her husband. And Dr. Hank Harris is here. He's the chair of the Department of Counseling at UNC Charlotte. What you wanted to say, Davy, before we had to go to the break was something that maybe most of us haven't ever thought about, at least in the non-African-American community, that these young men, these kids, don't have a childhood. They can't be kids. They can't be normal kids. They have to always watch themselves.
Did you see the video, one of these viral videos that were bombarded by on Facebook recently, where there was a kid playing in his neighborhood and he was arrested? I think he was 9 years old. The police officer put handcuffs on him, and they said there was a report. And he says, the police officer says, I am going to put – he's talking to him kindly as a kid. He says, I'm going to put cuffs on you for your safety and for mine. And the kid was apparently just playing in the neighborhood, and there was a call that there was other kids throwing rocks, but he was the only kid playing on a yard. And then he – walks the kids. He's talking to him very nicely as a kid, but he put cuffs on him. And then he placed him in the back. He's like, okay, I'm going to have you sit in the back of the police car. And as I'm watching this, my heart is breaking because all of these little nuances are changing this kid. He criminalized this 9-year-old instead of just, hey, where's your mother? He's asking him where his mother on, but he's putting the cuffs on a 9-year-old boy for his safety and for mine. It's just heartbreaking, this narrative.
This, and I think this is something a lot of us are now just beginning to see because of the existence of video and viral videos and camera phones that has gone on forever, but we haven't been able to see it. And we have two parents here. One's a counselor and one's just a parent. And I want to bring them into this to talk about this conversation that has been going on forever in the black community with parents and their children. Normally, what forms do these conversations take? Is this like the talk that every parent has to have at some point with their child? Or is this somehow different?
Yeah, I'll just start off here because I have four teenage boys, and two of them are driving age right now. We talk about race like we do the weather. We have to. And I look at it as a way to help them understand this world. While they are multiracial, I tell them society is going to see you as black. And so there are certain conversations that we have with them as a protective mechanism. Is it right? Is it wrong? No, I have to deal with reality. And that's what we have to do with them also. There are certain things that I tell them that this is what you have to do if you are ever stopped by the police. These are the behaviors that you have to display. Listen. Obey. Don't make any false moves, because a false move could be a deadly move. And I hate to say this.
They believe you when you first say that? I mean, before all these incidents became national television news, did they believe you?
Teenagers, sometimes they believe you with a grain of salt until something happens to them. And one of my sons was stopped, and I can tell you it shook him up a little bit just this past week.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. Stanley, I guess prior to Trayvon Martin, is it safe to say that you didn't really, that you were oblivious to this? You didn't really, you weren't aware of this kind of double standard?
Yeah, before the Trayvon Martin case, I didn't really know that there were balances in society, like one race was better than the other, or one race would treat one race differently just because of, like, their biases or just a fear of what they could do. But after that case, my parents talked to me about the differences in society and what to do if you were ever stopped. Our police officer just came up to you.
And what was your reaction? Do you remember? How do you feel about it right now?
Well, I'm grateful that they told me that at a young age, because at first I didn't really believe it, because I was still young, so I didn't really know that was really true. But as social media started getting bigger and more videos started going out, I started realizing that what they told me is true, and I actually started using that in real life.
What's it like to have the conversation, Venetia?
As a mom, it's tough. It's really tough. And like he said, at nine, we're not – at eight and nine, we're not having heavy dialogue about interactions with bad experiences with cops, because we've been fortunate and blessed that in our community, up until the conversation about Trayvon Martin, my son had always had positive experiences with law enforcement in our community. And we have members of our family that are in law enforcement. So he didn't grow up in an environment to fear the cops or to look at them with an hesitancy. He was taught and kind of walked around in a manner of being respectful with everyone, not really having a ton of fear. So the Trayvon Martin situation, when it happened, especially for him at that age, it demanded that we change the narrative a little, because as Davey mentioned earlier, I suddenly looked up and I'm thinking, we are in this neighborhood where everyone's nice. All of our kids play together. But at the time, he was the only African-American male. And so even though he, Andrew and Drew had been together their entire life, kind of playing together, at some point, let's fast forward 10 years. Mm-hmm. Again, if someone else new moves in and he's on a different side of the neighborhood, now does he become a threat because they don't know?
Yeah, why is this kid in my neighborhood?
Why is this kid in my neighborhood when in actuality he was in the neighborhood before
you were
in the neighborhood? So it's heartbreaking. But as Dr. Harris said, for us, talking about race and helping you to understand that the melanin in your skin, other people are going to view you differently. Mm. And I wanted to even quickly address when you asked him the question about the burden. You know, we definitely talk about, understand, walking around as an African-American male, that's your privilege and your blessing. But do understand that other people are going to view you differently. Other people are going to treat you differently. And so you just need to have that in the back of your mind when you're having certain interactions. Kind of like Davey said, someone else might get away with throwing a rock. Someone else might get away with simple teenage behavior. You don't get that pass. Because especially now that you're 13, you're viewed differently. And my son doesn't look like a 13-year-old. He looks a little older and a little taller. So you have to be conscious of how other people are viewing you. I still want you to live in your light and be authentic to yourself, but you have to walk and understand how society is viewing you and the implications of that. Mm-hmm. And so now to have to look at you and say, the message is, I just need you to get home. Mom and dad will handle whatever we need to with respect to if someone runs up on you. But your goal is just to get home. And a lot of families that don't have brown or black kids didn't realize we were just having to say that message. I just need you to get home.
Your neighborhood's in the film. It's a really nice neighborhood, obviously upper middle class socioeconomic neighborhood. Is it easier or harder to live in this world as opposed to being poor and living in this world?
I think that both come with their pockets of advantages and disadvantages, because I also happen to work with a nonprofit organization where I do a lot of work with lower socioeconomic families and communities. And the reality is that when you are brown and a male, it doesn't matter if your family is upper middle class, middle class, or in poverty. You're still an African American male. No one knows your socioeconomic status.
Dr. Harris, the African American communities live with this forever, but it's being amplified because of viral videos and because of media, et cetera, coverage of this, because people have phones and now they're taping everything and it all ends up in the national living room on television. Has that changed the nature or the urgency or the tenor of these conversations, and should it from your point of view?
I think it should change the tenor of it in the sense that we need to be talking about this more and do more than talk, react, and not just the African-American community, all communities.
I was going to say, is it time for white people to start having these conversations?
Oh, it's time for everybody to be involved. You know, denial is a powerful tool. And sometimes when people are in denial, they don't really see what's there. And so for years, African Americans have been seeing this, have been saying these things happen, but there's been no video. And what happens now is people will say in the African American community is that even with the video, how can this be? Mm-hmm. Is the video lying? Is the video being untruthful here? So where do we go from here? So when you see these young men being gunned down sometimes, and yet the verdicts are not guilty or there's an acquittal, you know, I think sometimes we're at an interesting state right now where many in the African-American community are wondering, where do we go from here?
Well, isn't this just another example of people having alternate facts, whether when they see a fact, it's not a fact if they don't believe it?
Perceptions, our worldviews are – once again, it's a powerful tool. Mm-hmm. Our life experiences help shape our worldviews. And for some people, not having these experiences or not willing to see what's actually there, sometimes individuals will cloud their mind and have this perception to not see what they want to see rather than what's actually there. And I think this is what happens with a lot of young African-American boys right now.
As a kid, until you're about 27, I understand, as a male, your brain is not fully formed. It happens a little quicker for females. But as a young person, your hormones are raging. Your emotions can sometimes get the best of you because everything's the end of the world. So when you're a young man, and you're confronted with this injustice, and that's what it is. Let's call it what it is. When you're confronted with this injustice, what do you say to your own sons? How do you control the rage about that must be just about to explode out of you when you're confronted with it, whether it's to you personally or whether you're seeing it on television?
I am so glad you asked me that, because one of the things that I tell them to do is to do not allow your emotions to cloud your thinking, as hard as that might be. Because when you allow your emotions to cloud your thinking, you may do something that could get you in a lot of trouble. When you are stopped by the police, when someone says something to you that's disrespectful, think before you react. Think before you react. And I say that over and over and over and over and over again, because as a young African-American-looking male, your reactions are going to be taken differently, and the reactions that others perceive could have dire consequences. So you have to tell them to think before you react, think.
Stanley, have you witnessed this yourself? Do you see your white friends that you play with, that you play basketball with, or whatever you do with them, do you see them being treated differently, regarded differently if you're out with them at a restaurant or at a movie theater or wherever you guys go, do you notice that?
Well, actually, most of my friends that I grew up with in that documentary, mm-hmm. most of them moved away. So in that neighborhood, it's just me. Well, it's not really just me now, but it's more like I'm more just isolated by myself. So the school that
why? Because there's nobody your age?
Yeah, because the oldest kid besides me there is like 10 years old.
Okay.
And the school that I go to is mostly African American school. So I wouldn't say that I don't usually go out with white people, but it's mostly I go out in a group with tend to be African American mm-hmm. people. And
is that healthy? To have, in other words, if we're going to have these discussions and we're going to break this down, so that we end it somehow, if that can be, if that's even possible. Can that, is it possible if we have situations like Stanley's in, where he, by necessity, because he goes to a fundamentally African-American school, he's not exposed to them, and they aren't exposed to him?
My nephews aren't either, the ones that are in that meme. They're in Atlanta and live in a nice neighborhood and go to a charter school where there are six children in each classroom, and it's a predominantly black. I asked them, I was like, are there any white kids? I asked them if there are any white kids in their class, mostly to get a gauge if they're identifying black and white people, at, like what they know. And they don't, they're not exposed to white people in that way. So I'm not sure if it's healthy, because I was recently on a trip or at a conference, and we were being shown around a nonprofit, and we automatically segregated ourselves. Yeah. And we called it, everybody in that group were activists, and we called it out, and we were like, whoa, we got off the elevator, and we all just, the black people stood by each other and the white people stood by each other, and we saw it. And we said, whoa, and had an audible, like, let's mix it up, right? So I think it's, I don't know.
That's- and Mike, I would say there definitely has to be intentionality of exposure. So both of my children are in the CMS system. Both of them started off at a wonderful magnet program, extremely diverse for elementary school. They went to different middle schools. My son is at Piedmont. My daughter's at Randolph. A very different makeup in terms of ethnic backgrounds. Her set of friends, I joke, look more like the United Nations. There's, right. You know, when we do things at the house or for her, there's someone represented from almost every country. Whereas him, as he said, most of his friends happen to be African-American males. But we make sure that we're putting you in environments intentionally where you are being exposed to other people, because I think it's important also not only just for you to understand other people's cultures, I think it's important that other people get to have a positive interaction with an African-American male that they may not otherwise.
It is part of the problem that by human nature, we are naturally suspicious of the other. Doesn't matter who the other is. Somebody not from our group, whether it's our tribe or whether it's our nationality or whether it's our neighborhood, we're naturally suspicious. So if we don't interact, doesn't that heighten the problem?
Well, I just want to speak to that. I think it does to a certain extent. What amazes me sometimes is as I watch young kids. Mm-hmm. When kids are really young,
they don't care.
They don't care about race.
Right.
They care about boy, girl. How fast can you run? What can you do? This and so forth. As we socialize them, we become more and more racially segregated. Then they begin to see differences. Then they begin to separate themselves. And so from a societal standpoint, one of the things that we've got to do is we've got to get a lot more comfortable addressing racial issues. Mm-hmm. Think about it. In 2017, Martin Luther King, Dr. King said this many, many, many decades ago, that the Sunday morning hour was the most racially segregated hour in the country. And today, I would argue, how much of that has actually changed? We've made a lot of progress, but so many things remain the same. And what we've got to do is we've got to really acknowledge that there is stuff still out there.
Right. Yeah, in 1947 or 1948, I've forgotten which year it was, but Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote South Pacific, and there's a song in South Pacific that says you have to be carefully taught, and it's about prejudice and how that prejudice develops. You have to be carefully taught. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Davy Sutton, Venetia and Stanley St. Villas, and Dr. Hank Harris talking about what we tell our sons about racial problems in America. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, committed to building a smarter energy future for the Carolinas. More at duke-energy.com/future. And McElveen Family Law, with 30 years combined experience helping couples and families through the process of divorce, custody, and alimony. Details at go.McElveenFamilyLaw.com/NPR. Once again, the Republican health care overhaul has unraveled in the Senate with the defection of two more GOP senators, meaning there aren't enough votes to even debate the Republican proposal. President Trump says Republicans should now try to just repeal the Affordable Care Act and work on replacing it later. So what is the next step for Republicans? Guest host Anthony Brooks takes a look at that during On Point in 20 minutes. Stay with us. We'll have more in a moment.
The never-ending cycle of breaking news alerts can make the world appear cluttered and confusing.
Premiums and deductibles for lower-income
older chains fell in the news of the Amazon Whole Foods deal.
Down to the meaning of one phrase, bona fide relationship.
That's why NPR makes space for clear, concise journalism and memorable stories. Make some space for yourself and stand with the facts. Listen every day.
Keep up with your NPR news source, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the film What We Told Our Sons. Families reacted to the Trayvon Martin verdict with the filmmaker herself, Davie Sutton. She's with us along with two of the people in the film, Venetia and Stanley St. Villas, a mom and son. And Dr. Hank Harris is with us. He's the chair of the Department of Counseling at UNC Charlotte. In the film, it is clear whether or not this talk that African-American parents have to give their sons, whether or not that talk is given. These young people live in this world. They see what's going on, and they see the influences. We see how it influences them. Here is how the young people in this film spoke about Trayvon Martin, the Zimmerman verdict, and the message that tragedy sent.
He was a black kid walking back from the store after he had Skittles and Arizona Icy.
Out of nowhere, George Zimmerman was in a car driving through the neighborhood as well because of his skin color, and he was wearing a hoodie at the same time, so he thought he was a robber. So he just jumped to conclusion and he just shot him.
My mom told me about the Trayvon Martin incident. I thought it was unfair because he was shot because he was looking suspicious because of his skin color. I don't think he would have shot a white kid if he was walking.
I believe he's like a symbol now. He was a regular black teenager, but now I believe he's like a symbol. All the young black males out there.
When I saw the picture of Trayvon Martin, it reminded me of my brother, my big brother, because they look like they're about this. They have the same type of this thing about them. It's like exactly the same, wearing hoodies and stuff. He didn't look like a bad person. He was smiling in all his pictures and stuff. He didn't look like a bad kid.
I guess I don't understand why we're treated differently just because our skin is a different color.
The saddest thing I've ever heard in a movie. Earl Alston is in this film. He's the father of three sons, and he says that he's talked to his sons about society's perception of blacks many times. Society, he says, has been conditioned to believe that a black guy in a hoodie is menacing. His wife, Stacy, has told her children that when they're outside the home, she wants them to be, quote, on point, alert, sharp, and professional at all times. Let's start with her comment. Isn't that a lot to put on children, Doctor?
It might be a lot to put on children, but it might bring your child back home alive. That's the other part of that. That's the reality of it all. When we take a look at what has happened over the past few years. And it's a survival mechanism. It's very similar to what my parents did to me in terms of teaching you how to act, teaching you how to give an image of yourself that will keep you out of trouble. And this is what we have to do now. I mean, again, it's a sad reality, but it's the reality that if we don't deal with, some of these kids may not come back home. I mean, that's the sad reality.
Why are we still talking about this? Seriously, I lived through the civil rights movement. I thought it was all over. A lot of white people thought, it's all over. Clearly, it is not all over. And we're not even a footstep away from where we were in many cases in 1968. Society is not well.
No.
How have you contained it? How have African Americans who are directly affected by this contained this all this time?
I'll say that part of the challenge for me raising a black male during the Obama era is that I kept hearing this post-racial word.
Yeah.
We're post-racial.
Yeah.
Everything's okay. You know, why are you still nervous about, you know, having your African-American male in certain situations? Why are we still having this conversation? Because the country has voted in a black president. And now we fast forward to 2016, 2017, and again, wherever you lie on the side of Trump, what I do believe is His candidacy and his presidency reminded the country that there is still a ton of hatred, a ton of racial issues, and race is a conversation that we have to have.
But how do you deal with what must be resentment and anger and frustration over having to have this conversation? You went through it when you were a child. Your parents went through it when they were children. Their parents went through it when they were children. And although things have probably arguably gotten a little better, you're still having to have this conversation. Stanley may have to have this conversation with his children.
Oh, he will.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. he definitely will. I think at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, we still have to have this conversation because race is always going to be an issue. And you do this as a way to, again, protect your sons.
And daughters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I also tell them that even though with all of this stuff that's out here, this still is the greatest country in the world. I will say this. We have opportunities here that others don't have in other countries. And I hope that they will reflect back on what I did in terms of even though we have lots of things still happening, the life that I have now is better than what my parents had. Is there stuff still out there? Absolutely. But it's better. And one of the goals that I want to do as a parent is what can I do to make things better for my sons? And we hope that that trend will continue.
In the break, both of you who are parents, are you a parent?
No, I'm not.
Well, both of you who are parents were talking about the talk. And you said, Doctor, that you are fearful when your four sons or teenagers go out with other African Americans with no white people mixed in. And you made a comment about that every time your children go out, you want to give them the talk again just to remind them, to inoculate them with this information about how you need to behave. That sounds exhausting to me.
Well, I think maddening. Yeah, I think most parents do kind of probably run down their standard rules, you know, when you're dropping them off at the mall or you're dropping them off at the movies, you know, hey, remember this, remember that. But for us as parents of color, as Dr. Harris and I were saying, we know that the difference between you really following the rules, listening to what we're saying, that's the difference between you coming home and not coming home, or you having an unnecessary interaction with, you know, security guard at the mall or a law enforcement officer that might be there. So it's even more imperative for us to run down these rules.
I mean, when I left the house when I was a teenager, my parents always said, you'd be back by 11 or be back by 10, whatever the curfew was. You call us if you're going someplace different than where we know you're going, et cetera. And it was like, oh, Mom, leave me alone. Stanley, how many times you just want to say, oh, Mom, oh, Dad, leave me alone?
Well,
Yeah,
that is true, but what they say is kind of true, because when me and my friend went to the mall once, it was after dark, because we just got out from a movie, and I don't think my mom was there. My mom was there because it was after my birth, because I was having a sleepover.
Okay.
So we just came from the mall, and we were waiting for a truck to get here because there was more people than my mom's car could carry. So we decided to play hide and go seek in the parking lot. And me and two of my friends, they went to go hide behind a car. And out of nowhere, a man came screaming and said, "Hey, get from behind that car before I call the cops." And he came out screaming and saying, "Hey, you think I'm playing? I'll for real call the cops. Get out of here before I'll call mall security, the cops, anyone he could get his hand, anyone he said he could call."
What's your reaction to that? What did you feel like?
I felt he just jumped to conclusions, because it's not like we were even that close to the car. It's like the car was actually probably like a couple of feet away from us.
And emails. For some white people who, like you mentioned, are surprised that this conversation is necessary for black families, what can we do?
So I always say black people have been outraged about what's going on for forever. It's getting woke white people to talk to other people. So white people need to talk to white people. We've been saying the same thing over as people of color. So what you can do is, now that you know this information, you can try to reach somebody else who may not know this information and start the wave of having people just realize that people are people. And we're just trying to move through this world and survive. And this is just one of the strategies that we're using to survive.
We're talking about men, African-American men, young African-American men for the most part. Do women face similar issues?
We certainly do. There's a lot of considerations. And a lot of times when we do this talk, we have the hashtag our sons. And depending on where we're presenting, whatever, like I said, story is relevant at the time, we will talk about daughters. And I explained to your producer, that is a can of worms, another set of can of worms of the considerations that you have to make as a woman. Am I going to wear my hair curly? No, I'm applying for a job and I need to wear my hair straight. The considerations that you have to make as a Black woman before you leave the house every morning, white people don't have to have. Like, am I going to be considered an angry Black woman when someone violated me and I'm actually angry, but I have to contain that anger because I don't want to be labeled an angry Black woman when I should have – we don't get the luxury to have the full range of emotions.
Yeah, we talked about this when Hillary Clinton was running for president, before we knew who the opposing candidates were going to be. One of the things that we talked about was the difficulty of being a woman running for a high political office or any position of power, because a man who is demanding can be just a boss. But a woman who is demanding can be the B word.
Emotional.
And it goes – and so when you add color to that, does that make it even – is that another layer?
Yes, it's another. So they have this term they call microaggressions,
right?
And I think what happens to us it starts at an early age. It's a subtle socialization of you're not worthy or you're not good enough, and these microaggressions accumulate in a day. And so you might reach somebody at the end of the day at their breaking point. If you see somebody going off on somebody, it might not just be that the Starbucks person didn't get their coffee right. It might be an accumulation of having to maneuver through these microaggressions and keep it suppressed. We learn to balance being, you know, what we say, like taking our wig off at home and just being with our people and having kitchen table talk, and then having to put on our corporate face and navigate through a white world.
What kind of a toll does this take on a person, period, but also their psyche?
Well, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois talked about this in 1903 in his book called The Souls of Black Folks. And he talked about this double consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so from a conditioning standpoint, this is why I think it's so important to have these conversations with young Black males. So it's, while it is an extra burden, it is a burden that they have to learn how to deal with in a successful manner. Mm-hmm. The reality of it all is, a lot of what we talk about with young Black males, it's normal parenting behavior for us, because we have to do this. We have to have these conversations. Is it a burden? It can be. The only other thing that I will tell you this also is that if you get an opportunity to read Days of Grace by Arthur Ashe 30 years ago, when Arthur Ashe found out he had AIDS, the reporter asked him, has this been the most difficult issue that he's ever faced? You know what Mr. Ashe said? He said, no, AIDS was not his, you know, it was not the greatest thing that he had ever faced. It was being Black. Mm.
This goes against everything we've talked about this hour, but there's a Black man named Isaac Bailey who wrote a column in Politico in 2015 talking about why he refuses to have the talk with his Black son.
I remember that.
And he goes into a litany of his experiences as a Black man and his reasoning, and he ends by saying, those with the most power have the most responsibility to correct wrongs. He says that having the talk simply perpetuates the myth that if only Black people would be perfect, all would go well. Racism would cease to exist, and rappers would never again have to make protest songs. I don't want my children believing that myth any more than I want them believing that cops, because of the color of their skin and the presence of a badge, are out to do them harm. What's your reaction to that?
So I think the foundation of his statement is based on a fallacy, because the reason that people are having the talk is out of necessity, not because they want to or they want to perpetuate a myth. On a micro level, the only thing people care about day to day is protecting their family and feeding their family. So the talk is a strategy to make sure that that person that they birth comes back home to them at the end of the night. So it's not that people on a day to day, on individual households across this country, they're not thinking about perpetuating a myth and all the, you know, nonsense that he. So I remember when he wrote that. And so I think the foundation of what he said is false.
Okay. You start this film, as we said, with the phrase on the screen, at what age do they become a threat? And you end the film with another phrase, unintended, but not a mistake. And that phrase is superimposed over the photographs of the many young men who have died since Trayvon Martin and the George Zimmerman verdict came out. Talk about that. That phrase, the meaning of that phrase. What are you trying to communicate?
So this is a film that kind of takes a look at systemic racism. Mm-hmm. When we talk generally in the media about racism or social injustice, we usually talk about an individual who may have said something racist, or there might have been a racist act, or we saw an individual social injustice. But there isn't much media out there that looks at what happens to a community, to a family, and what discussions happen within that family, and the trickle-down effect of it. And when you see these stories in the film, you kind of see, it first humanizes a family, but you get to see that it's not individual police officers, it's actually a system. Mm-hmm. And how do we change the system of what's going on?
Davy Sutton is a journalist, a filmmaker. She is the documentarian who produced and directed What We Told Our Sons, Families React to the Trayvon Martin Verdict, which will be screened at the Levine Museum of the New South on Thursday evening at 6:30. Venetia and Stanley St. Villas also with us, along with Dr. Hank Harris.